welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 18th, 2017. This is also the last time to encourage you to support WJCU and the work we do here at the station to promote great independent radio. Radiothon 2017 ends tomorrow, February 19th, and you still have time to pledge your support by calling 216-397-4438 and talking to a human being, or logging on to WJCU.org and clicking the pledge button. Won't you please take a moment and let us know that you appreciate the work that we do? We're all volunteers here, and our award-winning station, in fact, the number one college station in Northeast Ohio, got there by the hard work and commitment we make every day, all year long. So regardless of the amount of your pledge, we appreciate whatever support you can offer. Thank you. Moving on to this week's show, we have two great guests. In mid-January, frame builder Ben Serrata posted a photograph of a frame signed by him with the date January 12, 2017. And the cryptic headline said, "I'm back at it." But what did that mean? What does it mean going forward? Is he really building frames again? We're about to find out. My long history and interest in the pro end of the bicycle business began with the Serrata frame way back in 1974. Ben was also the first guest I had on the inaugural show of The Outspoken Cyclist in September of 2010. Now, a new chapter is about to begin with Ben, and I am thrilled to be able to talk with him. After a break, we'll be back to meet Sam Olinger. Sam is an accountant by trade, but after riding her bike for transportation while in college at Temple University in Philadelphia, then planning a cross-country trip with her then-boyfriend, now-husband, that ended somewhere in Texas, and finally landing in San Diego, she began her work in bicycle advocacy in earnest. Today, Bike San Diego, the organization she founded and still runs, is laser-focused on changing the way San Diego views alternative transportation, and her results are huge. So let's begin way up in Saratoga Springs, New York, as we welcome Ben Serrata back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Hi, Ben. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time to talk with me today, and a belated happy birthday.
Well, thank you, Diane. It is always a pleasure to speak with you on or off the radio.
That is correct. I get to see you. Well, I used to see you a lot. I don't see you as much anymore. I want to kind of go back to the last time we spoke, which, believe it or not, was early January of 2015, when you were doing some consulting and exploring some possibilities. What have you been doing the last couple of years?
Well, the bulk of the last 2 years, I spent doing projects for a bike share company, Brooklyn, New York-based bike share company called Motivate, who operates, they're actually the largest bike share operator in North America, largest based on the size of their collective fleets, but they do New York, Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Portland. It's a pretty different and pretty a wonderful piece of this of the bicycle related industry. It was fairly late in 2014, and I was actually rather close to launching a new small bike building business, and through a series of phone calls and so forth, I came in contact with the people who were acquiring a five-year-old bike share business, and we had some wonderful conversations about changing the urban landscape, and it connected with me in a way that I, was reminiscent of how I felt about the environmental movement in the late '60s. It was just something it really pulled at me in a positive way. And they needed some supply chain help and some product help, and it was so far removed from what I'd been doing. It just it was very intriguing. I'd spent the bulk of my previous 40 years with a goal of trying to build one perfect bike at a time, for an athlete who could afford to have the best bike or was fast enough to earn it somehow. And this is just polar opposite. This was a one-size-fits-all bike that fit everybody well and was completely utilitarian and heavy-duty and that almost everyone can afford to use. I say almost in that it is by far the least expensive means of public transportation other than walking, and most people can take advantage of it. So it was a refreshing change. And so I actually relocated to Brooklyn for about 2 years, close to 2 years. And so that's largely what I've been up to.
Well, I knew that you had moved to Brooklyn. I wasn't sure what you were doing. You know, we do a lot of advocacy conversation on the show, and certainly bike share is a big part of it. And it's interesting that bike share has gotten as big as it is, and yet it still seems to be a quiet part of the industry. Electric bikes are getting a lot of, electric assist. But bike share just seems to be growing sort of organically beneath the surface.
Yeah, it's one of those things in an odd way, it reminds me of when triathlon was, or BMX, whenever a new segment has rubbed itself against the bike industry, there has been this sort of reaction that ranges from indifference to sort of negative, like, why don't you leave us alone? Because we don't think we can make any money being involved with you. And what's interesting about bike share, and for the most part, the bike industry itself, and you know, we think of the bike industry, it's bicycle retailers and bicycle parts distributors and so forth. For the most part, the bike industry has kind of ignored bike share to a degree. Again, largely because it hasn't figured out how we can make money off. And in many cases, bike shops see the bike share systems as competition to them, because people can get to use bikes and abuse bikes and not have to pay for maintenance. And bike share operations have their own maintenance teams. And it's very sad because, well, the good news is the bike share world hasn't been deterred by the reaction of the bike industry, and users, you know, are embracing it. And so people who are lifelong cyclists are using it, and people are learning to ride bikes so that they can use it. It runs that range. And it's one of the things that the bike industry, the commercial bike industry, has, I think, suffered throughout our shared lifetime working with, and it is it has a hard time looking at the long big picture, which is that anything we can do to grow the pie is probably going to be better for all of us in the long run. And so even if you don't see a direct way that your own business can benefit by public bike share in this case, you know, it doesn't mean that there's going to be immediate benefit, but in the long term, you know, bike share is changing how municipalities look at bicycling. It's you know, lowering traffic congestion. It will, if given an opportunity, it will significantly lower maintenance costs of roadways, because bicycles don't put nearly the abuse on the surface of paths and roadways that cars do. So anyway, it's a
so
it's,
interesting
it's a
different to world. Hear you talking about bike share like this, because I think of you as such a different person, but I can hear such a shift in the way you're thinking that I can't wait to hear what we're going to talk about next.
Okay.
So, you know, my history with you goes back a long, long way. It was one of your frames back in my store in 1974 or 75 that made me interested in the high-end pro market. And that was where I set my sights. And that's where, you know, we went for all those years as a high-end pro shop. It was a 23-inch steel-lugged burgundy frame, and I loved it. I don't even remember who bought it. It broke my heart when somebody did, though. But at any rate, then a couple weeks ago, here's this beautiful Ferrari red, fire engine red, fillet brazed, it looked like, frame, and it's signed with your name, and it has January 12th, 2017, and I think something like, back at it. And I'm like, what the hell? And just what I sent you a message saying. That was my headline, right? What the hell? So what the hell?
Yeah. Well, you know, so it's sort of like a bike share to me is kind of like bread and water. It provided some necessary sort of recentering to me. I mean, my absolute favorite photograph that has anything to do with cycling is a photograph of a young boy riding a bike in the snow. And I can't remember the name of the photographer right now, which I'm kicking myself for. But anyway, it's a photograph that absolutely captures the feel that you have when you're riding a bike, when you just are riding a bike for the first time or second time or third time as a kid, and it works. You just feel this overwhelming sense of freedom. I think most people have that. And so, you know, in my core, that I'm that. But I also realized that working in bike share was leaving a lot of things on the table that I really missed doing, like me getting my hands dirty and making something, and the sound of cutting metal and sparks and flames and grinding. I realized that bike share took me so far away from the world I've been in for 40 plus years that I was kind of looking at it suddenly with fresh eyes, because I realized what I was really missing was actually making things and making really nice things. So I realized sometime over the course of last year that I needed to do that again without necessarily a plan of what I was going to do beyond doing it for myself first. And the bike I've shared some photos of is the first bike I've made by myself, for myself, in quite a long time. And the very first bike I made for myself was bright red. And so this bike had to be red also. But, you know, behind it, once I made the decision I was going to do that, I don't like doing things halfway. So I started spending money. Of course, I reconnected with the folks at Columbus Tubing in Italy, and I did some redesign and updating of a specialty steel tube set, similar to those that they've done many versions of for us in years past. But I spent some money, and I mean, I couldn't help it. I wanted to update this bike. Again, without really having a plan of what I do other than making one. But I had some new tooling updated. I worked with Jay Clark, my favorite ID guy who had worked for Serata for a number of years and is now freelancing. And we redesigned one and then a second style of new steel dropouts. And anyway, so I suddenly have stuff in play. I had a great time making one frame. I've made a few more. I have a number of friends, customer friends, who've been prodding me for more than a few years to what I consider making a bike again. So I have a few people that I'm finishing making some frames for, but I've decided to do a small production batch of tubing with Columbus because, you know, they did all these samples based on the notion that I was probably going to buy some tubing. And there are details that I'm a couple of weeks behind on formalizing, truthfully. What I can tell you at this point is that I'm going to do, it doesn't mean that now is the last time for the rest of my life that I can make bikes, but I'm probably going to not sell more than about 30 that I do all the way through, because I only want to do this as long as I'm having a good time doing it. And if I open up the floodgates, so to speak, it's hard work to do, make nice bicycles, but it's fun work. And I want to keep it in that bracket of fun work and not just let it become work again. On the other hand, because I don't have my own, I lost a great workshop a few years back, And so I've actually been working out of the frame shop that Frank Waddleton has in Vermont. Frank is known as Frank the Welder, just a wonderful and talented machinist, welder, creative thinker, bike guy. And so I've been going over to his shop to build these bikes. And I'm going to do some additional quantity of bikes. I'll take orders for bikes that will be fully TIG welded. I've all TIG welded that I'll braze some bridges in and do a couple little detail things on. So I'll do some number of those bikes as well. So it will be a little business for a while. And this is not me starting to launch a brand that has huge or long-term expectations, or just kind of going to take it a step at a time. And with a focus on making sure it's fun.
Let me take a second to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ben Cerrato. We're going to take a real quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to We're going to continue the conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Ben Cerrato, who is got a torch in his hand again. I want to know how that feels.
Well, you know, it feels great.
that was easy.
It feels great. It feels great. You know, I started out, I was the first frame builder, then Marcy, my wife, became the second frame builder, and then a fellow named Tony Angotti, who I hope listens to these, became the third of us. And, you know, and over time, we slowly added staff at Cerrato. But it was probably by the early to mid-90s, so that was 20 years in, I was beginning to phase myself out of day-to-day production duties and, became more the conductor of the orchestra rather than one of the first seats. But by that time, I personally brazed many thousands of frames. Most of them were lug-style construction, which these current bikes are not. But I'd done Philip Braze bikes in the mid-70s, I guess. When track bikes, pursuit bikes were first dabbling with aerodynamics, and frame tubes didn't fit into any lugs that existed. So I started doing some fillet brazing that long ago, and we actually did tandems for a while. Any time there was something super custom, the pursuit track bikes that were made in the 80s with very aero tubing and one-piece handlebars that were brazed to the pursuit frames that had aero handlebars that were custom made and fillet brazed that were fillet brazed onto the front fork. So I had a lot of experience doing fillet brazing as well as lug style brazing, but I had done very little of that since the mid-1990s, and other than an occasional repair or just fun project that might be completely different. But the thing is that when you light the torch, you get this little bit of a pop. And I was a little nervous until I heard that pop, and it was just there. I was very comfortable, immediately comfortable doing it. And which was a relief.
Yes, I'll bet it was. Although it's, you know what they're going to tell you, right? It's like riding a bicycle. You never forget.
That's right.
Right. Right.
There are other analogies as well, but yes, it's just so satisfying.
That's a good, I like that. That's really good. So I want to talk a little bit about the changes that have occurred since you started, since you then left, since you've come back. You know, until about 13 years ago, there was no such thing as a handmade bike show. And then Don Walker put together that first handmade show in Texas, and now it's grown to this enormous sort of alternate trade show that a lot of people attend and look to for innovation and a lot of new things, even though it's not like it's not the big manufacturers like Trek or Giant or Specialized. We're talking, you know, people like Tim O'Donnell and Don Walker and Ben Cerrada. So how do you think the show has changed the artisan community and the people who look at it, the people who buy these bikes?
How do people look at the NABS show?
Yeah, do you think NABS has changed the artisan community and the way people look at production over custom?
I think people who are on the inside of that niche feel that it has. I'm not so sure, you know, in terms of if we're to step outside of bikes, the bike world, and look in, I think that, you know, to a relatively small population, it has helped the warm fuzziness of what having handmade product is, real handmade product. But I don't think it's changed, you know, globally the perception all that much.
Interesting.
If it had, small bike builders would be overrun with work, and they're not. That, you know, which isn't to try to paint a picture of doom and gloom at all, but I think it's a pretty small community overall, and I think there are a lot of people who, you know, have spent a lifetime buying and trading and selling. As it's the community of people that sell each other their second and third and fourth hand bikes over and over and over again. And the number of people who are new to appreciate what the small building community does, I think, is not as large as we would hope it would be.
Yeah, maybe because we're in it that we don't really.
Yeah. I mean, the you know, people are riding bikes. You know, the good news, and not to go back into bike share, but the good news is if you step outside of the little community of high-end bike builders, there's no question at all that more and more people are riding bicycles, and more people are riding bikes on a regular basis, and more people own nice bikes, meaning bikes that are meant to be ridden a lot, not necessarily custom. And so I think the overall state of cycling is in the healthiest place it's been in and getting healthier. But on the other hand, retail is in a time of complete chaos. It doesn't matter if it's bicycles or shoes or guitars or cars or whatever it is. It's total chaos, and we're over bombarded with stuff. And as a whole, people are more comfortable. I mean, one of the problems with politics is that people are more comfortable believing whatever they read on their, you know, idiotic device. No one really has the time. Nobody wants to take the time to dig deep into anything. So the good news is, you know, it gives everybody a chance to try to talk their way or worm their way into doing business. And so there's just a tremendous amount of product. And I think, you know, by and large, well, it's been proven that a lot of people are willing to believe whatever they're told.
Yes, so, isn't that true?
That is true for anything, including bikes. So I'm not skeptical about the future for small builders of handmade, you know, handmade product. But I think it still is a more of a noble way to try to make a living than one that you can just guess that you're going to prosper in.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about technology, because you were still talking about steel bikes from you. Carbon fiber has kind of taken over the production market. We now have electronic shifting. How are you seeing that technology as far as the bike business goes? And do you think it'll ever sort of kind of washed itself out that, you know, we go in these phases. First it was steel and then it was aluminum and now it's, then it was carbon and aluminum and then it was carbon and now it's carbon, carbon, carbon. And now I'm seeing a lot more change again, I think, or not. What do you think?
Yeah, the reason the bikes that I'm building and I've dubbed, I didn't want people to think that I was restarting Cerata again. So that I'm dubbing, and since I'm making more than one bike, I'm making a little brand called Moto Mio, which means my way. And it's all about, I'm going to make some bikes the way I feel like making some bikes. And at the moment, I feel like making some steel bikes. And because for many reasons. I don't steel, as an example, is a material that it has, if it were a musical instrument, it has a sound that other materials can come close to, but it's not the same. And you could say the same with about any of the metals, really, titanium or aluminum. The metals are sort of more unique that way, and that why you can modify the performance and behavior of each metal. They steel, there are boundaries that steel will stay in, and aluminum and titanium that whether it's changing the alloy slightly or the shape and so forth, there's still behavioral qualities for each metal that are unique to that metal. Carbon fiber is a designer's dream material. If you have an open-ended budget and open access to materials, it's just this fabulously enormous range of performance attributes that you can have access to. So it's, carbon fiber doesn't have a way of behaving specifically because of how you use it. You can alter performance in many different ways. And I don't think that carbon fiber is, carbon or composites are not going to take, if you're looking at the sort of an absolute performance potential, composites are not likely to be, their place at the leading edge is not going to be supplanted by any of the metals probably ever again. Doesn't mean that metals can't make great product though. And just because carbon fiber can be this ultimate material product group, it doesn't mean that anything made out of composite material is a great product, because there's a tremendous amount of pretty crappy composite product in the marketplace. And it also makes it more difficult for people to understand. Composite structures are a long way away from black and white. You can own three different carbon fiber tennis rackets, bicycles, what have you, and the performance and durability can be quite different. And so, the metals are nice. Another nice thing about metals is that from a recycling standpoint, any one of the metals can be recycled effectively and economically and turned back into something, different or the same pretty economically compared to carbon fiber composites, which the technology for efficiently recycling in a usable way is still, there are processes that are being done, but it's a long way from being normalized. So again, I've got, in addition to the Moto Mio steel bikes, I have another bike project that I'm working on that's a little bit premature for me to talk about. But what I can say is I'm actually doing that in aluminum, which is a little bit different for me. But I really like what I found in terms of the most recent technology, manufacturing technology and alloys. And anyway, so I'm playing with metals.
Playing with metals.
Yeah.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ben Cerata about what he knows about best, which is bicycles. And, well, you probably know a lot about a lot of things, but for sure, the way I know you is through bicycles. So the last thing I want to talk about is something that I look at you as sort of a pioneer, and I picked up on it very, very early in my bicycle career, and that's fitting. So we have always used a Cerata size cycle. I can't even tell you how far back it goes, probably 1989. And I don't have the original one. I have another one, but it's the same. It was the improved model. I cannot imagine doing my work without fitting people. I just want you to say a few things about how fit developed for you. And because I talk to a lot of frame builders who go, oh, yeah, I just tell people to send me their measurements. And I don't see it that way. I need to see the body. It makes a difference to getting perfect fit. I just want to get your perspective on that.
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, that was a freebie for me.
You're welcome.
The reason I developed the SciCycle, the first one, and those after, wasn't because I wanted to change how the industry fit bikes. I just wanted to deliver bikes that fit to my customers. And, you know, the SciCycle, though, is a tool. You know, I bike fitting in general, it's still a very imperfect science. And on one hand, it's nice because the achieving the best fit, and absolutely, there's no question that a cyclist who has a bicycle built underneath them that that is designed for how that individual can move. I mean, cycling is about movement. That the bicycle will handle better because weight distribution will be optimized, and they'll be able to ride farther, longer, faster, whatever, based on, you know, how well that bike is designed to work with their body. And without question, the best bicycle fitters are people who really know how to ask the right questions and know how to read somebody's body. You know, the hard part is that those individuals, I'm pretty convinced it's a combination of natural talent. You know, some people can read how somebody moves better than others, and some people want to be great at that more than others. You have to kind of, you personally, you know, have that ability and also have the desire, because you can't just feel that you know how to do it and then you're great at it. It's something that I find that almost with every fitting, if you give yourself a window to try to learn something, you can learn a little bit from almost every fitting that you do. And so a really great bike fitter having the right tools, and a SciCycle, you know, doesn't do the fitting, as you know, it's just a tool. It's
right.
That allows you to move the cyclist in an infinite range of positions. And the best fits will be done with a great fitter who has the right tools to do that. But the right tools don't guarantee a good fit.
No, I agree. I do agree.
And so, you know, I think a lot of the systems that have always been in place, you know, from the relatively crude charts that were put together by the Italian Cycling Federation back in the 70s to the New England Cycling Academy's Fit Kit, which was another version of ways to take measurements and comparing them essentially to a printed database at that time, to even some of the systems now that have a device like a SciCycle, but you're kind of feeding information into a database. You know, all those systems now in their best are probably better than having a bike fitter using a holistic method who's not a particularly good fit. So, you know, it is, it's something that as a consumer, it's still a little intimidating, I find, as I've talked to people over the last couple of years when I've been out of the middle of that. Bike fitting is still, people know that having a bike that fits is important, but there are still so many fitting methods that are being pitched at the cycling public that it's confusing, you know, for someone who isn't sure of what they need exactly, you know, to pick the right system.
Yeah, I have found that a lot of people invest in very high-end systems, which give them lots of numbers. But if you don't know what to do with those numbers, they don't matter. You know, I've had many customers come back to me with their fitting numbers and saying, and my back still hurts. You know, my hands still fall asleep.
Sure.
My knees don't. So I have to agree. It is, and experience, you know, having been a fitter since 1984 is different from somebody who learned a year ago, you know, and having thousands of people go through the system. And you're absolutely right. Every time you do a fitting, you learn something. And today's cyclist is older and has more issues than 40 years ago, you know, when we're looking at somebody who has a knee replacement or a hip replacement or something like that. Very different.
Or hoping to prevent people
that are going to be on
their way to getting a knee replacement.
Right.
Yeah. It's a, you know, I think bike fitting is, it's another area that the industry would be wise to take ownership of somehow. You know, there have been a number of efforts to formulate the associations of bike fitters, and you know, the sad thing is it's become very competitive. There are too many people who are trying to make businesses out of bike fitting, and so there, you know, there's our egos at play and so forth. And it would be another one of those things that would be really smart for the bike industry to really take ownership of.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? Well, you know what? I don't even want to tell you how long we've been talking because you won't even believe it. And we could have this conversation for the next 5 hours and probably would still never get it done. I do have to ask that you'll come back again and talk to me again when the next phase of Bensurata gets unveiled.
Absolutely.
And I hope to be able to catch up with you again, you know, when I get to see you in person, which isn't too often these days. So thank you so much.
We'll have to make it happen. And
we can
you're
do that.
Very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
And thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you so much.
All right, Ben.
And,
take care of
we'll
yourself.
We'll do it again.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bensurata, always a pleasure to talk with him. He has so much to offer the industry, and I loved hearing it. I loved hearing about his experiences with bike share and how that sort of shifted the way he's thinking. I know that we spent a long time talking, and we need to keep moving on. If you want to know more, you can follow Ben on Facebook, Serotta, Bensurata, one of the premier frame builders of our generation. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back after a very short break. Sam, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here.
It's my pleasure. So one of my listeners said I just had to talk with you. My listeners give me the best guests. It's awesome.
I didn't know I had fans, so that's very exciting.
You do have fans. You evidently have quite a few fans. So I know you're now in San Diego, but why don't you take us back to the East Coast. You hail from the Philadelphia area. Tell us a little bit about where you went to school and how you got into cycling.
Sure. I'm a graduate of Temple, and I lived in the city when I was in Philly, kind of all around the place. I lived in West Philly, Center City, and South Philly. And I used to ride quite a bit. I would say I definitely rode for practical use. Like, I rode to school, the grocery store, to work, parties, the usual stuff. But I would say I was mostly a pedestrian or a transit user. And I really started using the bike a lot more because I wanted to save money. When I was going to school, my goal was to graduate with as little debt as possible. And bikes were just an easy way of doing that. Philadelphia is such a compact city, though, so I used to just pretty much walk most places. And at the time when I was in Philly, I didn't know about things like hand mirrors or lights. So I used to just sort of carry everything on my back. And times when I wouldn't ride, it's just because I had back pain. But as far as my riding, I would say I just rode as often as possible to pretty much everywhere.
What kind of a bike were you riding in those days?
I started out with a mountain bike that my then boyfriend, now husband, bought me from Penn Usenet Group for $100. And he kind of fixed that up for me. And then I later graduated to my first bike, which was like a Trek mountain bike, which had shock absorbers, because I wanted to ride in comfort. And in retrospect, it was kind of a bad bike to ride in many ways because it was very heavy. It was nice to ride on streets that were had potholes and things like that, but it was not a very good commuting bike, I don't think. And then right before I left, about a year prior to me leaving Philly, I wound up buying a Philly long-haul trucker, which is a bike I still have to this day.
Nice bike.
And I love it.
Yeah, they're nice. Is it green?
Yes, it's that military green.
Because I just leased a Subaru Outback in Wilderness Green. So
I
know that color very well. So you decided to take a cross-country trip, but it got...
Yes, I did.
Short-circuited. Were you by yourself on your cross-country trip?
I was with my husband. I sort of talked him into riding with me across the country. He wanted to move to the West Coast, and I talked him into riding with me on a bike to get to the West Coast.
So you had to stop in Texas.
Yes. We didn't have to stop. We just chose to stop.
Ah.
And we left Philly, I believe, in August of 2008. And we were sort of racing against the winter. But it was a beautiful time to ride because we kept seeing the colors change. So the fall was really beautiful. Honestly, I didn't do a whole lot of thinking about the tour. So I wasn't in very good shape at the time. And the entire tour, I was just in pain pretty much every day. And that really made for kind of a miserable experience in some respects. The other component was when we were riding through Texas, a lot of people kept telling us that the violence in the border region near Juarez was really bad. And there was no way for really us to gauge on how accurate that was because we would be, the way we had planned our route was to go through El Paso to cross over into New Mexico. And I was a little nervous about whether we would run into trouble. And the most I'd ridden during that tour was really 80 miles. Texas is a very big state, and oftentimes there were not a lot of towns within 120-mile range. So I was really nervous about whether we would have enough food and water, if we broke down, what would happen. And we didn't really have a whole lot of technology on us. I had a very simple flip phone, and that was it. And so I was kind of nervous about sort of making all the way across Texas at the time, given limited technology, limited information, sort of the fear-mongering around the violence at the border. So we pretty much stopped and decided to maybe continue to some other day, but we just rented a U-Haul and then drove to San Diego.
And that's where you are to this day.
That's correct.
In San Diego. Well, one of the things I noted was that when you moved to California, you decided you would live in the city so you would not actually have a need for a car. Do you own a car?
We bought one 3 years ago, so right now we do, yes.
Okay. But you came from a place, you know, in the East where it's fairly congested, and riding a bike, while it might be dicey in the streets, still gets you where you need to go, grocery, dry cleaner, that kind of thing. When I think of California, it's so spread out. Where did you find a place in San Diego where you can ride your bike to all the places you need to go?
Well, the older parts of the city, which is called the urban core, is not too dissimilar from Philly, actually. There's a grid structure, the city street, it's fairly compact and dense, and stuff is pretty accessible and pretty close to one another. So we actually picked a neighborhood originally called North Park, which is sort of an up-and-coming hip neighborhood that is pretty walkable. There's bus service that runs there frequently, and it's not terrible to bike in. I would say it's no different from, say, living in South Philly. So it's very similar to that. But if you live in some of the newer neighborhoods, which are much more suburban, San Diego is also a very hilly city, which a lot of people don't know. So that actually poses much more of a challenge. But because you don't have, I think, the downside of the bad weather, I think it makes for, it sort of counteracts some of the negative aspects of living here. But in general, it's no different from living anywhere else. I mean, we lasted 7 years without a car. It wasn't necessarily easy or tough. It was just a choice we made. And I don't regret it. If you want to do it, you can totally do it. Depends on where you live.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sam Olinger, founder of Bike San Diego. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. There was an article in the San Diego Union Tribune. This is sort of at the beginning, before you actually, I think, formed Bike San Diego as a nonprofit organization, that cited you as the blogger. What was the focus of your blog, and what was that all about?
So the site that's now part of the nonprofit, bikesd.org, was originally started as a blog. and two friends and myself, we started the website to blog about cycling issues in San Diego. And we essentially wrote about our own perspectives of what was it was like to ride a bike for transportation. What was it like to ride on your morning commute? What was it like from sort of the political aspect of things? Who were all the bureaucrats that affected, you know, bike infrastructure in the city? It was sort of a quasi-personal slash policy-based blog. And so that was the blog that eventually became the website for the organization.
So blogging and Bike San Diego at that time was not your full-time job. You're an accountant by trade.
That's correct.
Are you still an accountant?
I have some clients on the side, but for the most part, the advocacy has taken up essentially all my time at this point.
Okay. And that's what I want to talk about, because evidently your organization, looking at your website, it's very dense. There's a lot of things going on in it. And I want to know about Bike San Diego. You have some really lofty goals. Tell us a little bit about what the organization does and what kinds of things it's got on its planning table right now.
Sure. Before I talk about sort of what we do specifically, I think it's important for your listeners to know sort of the bike advocacy organization universe in a whole. Most bike advocacy organizations tend to have two focuses or a singular focus. One is usually they do a lot of outreach and events and education-based stuff. So they teach kids how to ride a bike, pay for after school, they have classes. So there's a whole component of education that funds their work. That's how they get a lot of the grants and so forth.
Right.
And often a lot of them also have an advocacy component, which relates to changing policy at the state or the region or the whatever sort of their jurisdictional perspective is. We don't do any education the way traditional bike advocacy has done it. We don't have classes. We don't hold, you know, sort of safe routes to school sort of programs. We don't have any of that. What we do is pretty much straight up grassroots advocacy, advocating at City Hall, at our regional decision-making tables, encouraging our members to run for office at the various community groups that influence city decisions. And it's all with a singular focus of changing the street structure to make it more accommodating for bicycling. And that is essentially our sole laser focus effort of the entire existence of the organization.
And what have you accomplished so far? What kinds of changes have been made? What kind of people have been able to be elected and put into place to help achieve your goals?
Lots of different things. It's sort of a multi-pronged approach towards a singular goal. The first thing is obviously you need the funding to ensure that the streets can be changed. And what you alluded to earlier, often people think of California as a very car-centric region, and it's very much the focus of the automobile and California goes hand in hand. So a lot of decisions that have been made politically, from a policy perspective, from a funding perspective, has been to the detriment of biking and even walking, but it's been to the utmost comfort of driving a car. So it's extremely convenient to get around in a car in San Diego. That's largely because of those funding decisions that have been made historically. And so the first thing we focused on was trying to ensure that bikes were part of the political conversation with our mayor, our council members, our county supervisors, sort of everyone that had an ability to vote on public funding. They would focus on funding bike infrastructure. And partly the reason for that is, you know, besides the fact that it's good for health and it's great for our organization's missions and so forth, any changes you make now towards making driving better is just going to result in very, very small marginal gains, because driving is amazing in San Diego. There's really no reason to keep throwing even more money to it. So those funding decisions have been a big push of it. Then comes the policy elements of it. So ensuring that our streets are safe, so advocating for infrastructure that makes riding safe for all age groups of people of all abilities, making sure that all voices are heard when it comes to getting around in the city, and then making sure that our members and supporters are actively a part of the decision-making process. So making sure they show up to City Hall, they call their elected, they show up to town hall meetings, that they're speaking up about those sort of things. Then getting policies actually changed at the city level. We work with a couple of different organizations, so we work to ensure that Vision Zero becomes a goal, which is a policy initiative to reduce all traffic fatalities to zero within 10 years. We got the city to adopt NACTO, which is a guiding document of street design to help engineers move away from making our streets seem like highways and rather make them design them to be more like city streets where multiple users are using them. So that's been sort of like the overall focus of both the policy, the political, and the funding elements.
Let me remind our listeners again, my guest is Sam Olinger. She is the executive director of Bike San Diego, obviously in California. Your three objectives are wonderful, but let's take it out of San Diego for a moment because infrastructure is a huge on-the-table conversation nationwide. Are you getting any pushback for cycling when there's so many other issues that are being sort of touted as way important? I mean, there's so many big issues right now. How are you able to keep, you know, moving forward with all these projects?
Of course, in any issue, especially when it relates to changing the primary paradigm that's been the norm for decades, you're going to get pushback. That's inevitable. I don't see certain things as really that different. I mean, immigrants ride bikes. Everyone, no matter what their identity or whatever, they ride a bike. So at the end of the day, mobility, I think, is a universal theme that everyone can agree on. Everyone needs to get places safely. And I think that that reality sort of cuts across whatever issue. I don't think there's a single person in the country who would say that our infrastructure is perfect as is. Everyone is going to talk about the improvements. The question is what degree of the improvements are going to be, how much are we willing to fund these improvements, and who gets to benefit from these improvements. I don't think it's necessarily a useful way to look at it in the sense of like cycling is sort of this weird marginal issue, but it's very much a part of the mainstream discourse because it's a solution that addresses so many problems. We've got health problems, we've got an obesity crisis, we've got people suffering from heart disease, we've got people dying on the streets, you've got streets that are underfunded as far as maintenance goes. Bicycling is something that it cuts across all the different issues to provide a very simple solution that a lot of people can embrace.
I love it. The question is, you know, do other people love it? Do the right people love it? Because the political climate seems so charged right now. So looking at your website, I'm going to take a little bit of a shift here. There is something coming up called Carnival Caffeination.
Yes, it was a fundraiser that actually just happened last Saturday.
Oh, it did. Well, it's got a great logo. Did you make money?
Yes, we did. It's actually a local brewery. They've been an incredible supporter of our work, Modern Times Beer. So if any listeners are out there looking for beer recommendations, I totally recommend Modern Times Beer. And they put on this fundraiser for us, so we would be the primary beneficiary of this festival. And it was an outstanding festival.
Oh, excellent. So what is the next big project on your plate? What are you going after for 2017 right now? Do you have one or two specific projects that are on the table?
Yes, we have something that's called the Downtown Mobility Plan. San Diego is a city of neighborhoods, like many places, but much more so here. We had a plan that was passed, adopted by city council, and we're trying to get that plan funded. And it's a plan that specifically calls for biking and walking infrastructure in the downtown of San Diego, which calls for a whole host of changes on our streets. So converting one-way streets to two-ways, converting three-lane one-way streets to bike lane streets, plus lanes for cars. And so a lot of road diet. Everyone's familiar with that wonky term. That's a big fit push. And so as our city budget process is underway, we're advocating to get more funding towards biking to implement the downtown mobility plan. That's one component of it. As far as like fun activities, we're planning on a ride called Bikes and Beer. It's going to be approximately 20 miles. It's going to happen on April 8th. And it's a very fun, casual ride. It's geared towards people who don't ride regularly but want to get into the habit of riding. And so if you've got a bike in a garage, you're encouraged to come out and do the ride. And it's often at a conversational pace. And it goes from sort of very urban neighborhoods to the beaches and the bay. So it's very scenic as well. That's one thing we're planning. And the second thing, which I alluded to earlier, was Vision Zero. We're trying to get that funded as well so we can start addressing the most deadliest streets in San Diego and make them safer for people to ride and walk and drive.
Big plans. Sounds like big plans. And I hope you do really, really, really well out there. So I have always three questions I like to ask my guests before we then give our listeners a chance to find out more about how to find out about you. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is usually tacos, and San Diego tacos are outstanding, so I love carne asada tacos and shrimp tacos.
All right. Do you and your husband have any pets?
We don't. We have, I don't know if you'd call them worms, but we compost. If worms are pets, we have worms for pets in our compost bin.
Got it. And what kind of music do you like to listen to?
I usually listen to anything from jazz to trip hop. I like to listen to a lot of instrumental stuff when I'm working, especially, so that's my favorite on Pandora.
Okay. Well, this has been an enlightening conversation about biking in San Diego, and I'm trying to remember, I think his name was Rich, the guy who told me, I needed to talk to you, and he always gets me good guests. I don't know. He listens to the show, and he goes, oh, so-and-so. You know, bicycling is so connected in so many ways.
It's really funny how many people I know throughout the country just because of biking.
Right.
And not because I run an organization either. It's just like, this is sort of like a very tight-knit community that you all know one another. It blows my mind every time, and I love it.
We are all connected. That is true. So please tell our listeners your website and how to find out more.
Sure. Our website is bikesdforsandiego.org, or you can just Google bikesandiego.org to get to our website. And if you want to know more, you can follow us on Twitter at bikesd, our Facebook site, bikesd, as well as Instagram. And if you want to know more, you're more than welcome to always email me, sam@bikesd.org. I'm happy to answer questions or to chat about biking or anything else.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Good luck with all of your big projects. It does sound like a lot of big projects, but watching what San Diego's doing might make other cities sit up and take notice and maybe be able to get some of their projects going. Thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
All righty. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye. Sam Olinger joined me from her offices at Bike San Diego in San Diego, California. Obviously, a great place to bike, I guess, because she's doing all this great work. I'd like to take a moment to thank Ben Serrata for giving me so much time and such a great conversation today. Remember, one more time, I lied, yes, one more time, Radiothon. Please take a moment to pledge your support at WJCU.org or call 216-397-4438. This is the last time you're going to hear me say that in 2017. That's our show for tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. Come back next week. We're going to have a conversation with adventure cyclist Mike Demme and more surprises. I hope you have a chance to go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.